Welcome to episode 285 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. My guest today is highly influential among energy systems thinkers. By that, I mean folks who grapple with the enormous complexity of the modern energy system and the best way to navigate the global energy transition. Among other positions, Dr. Doyne Farmer is the Bailey Gifford Professor of Complex Systems Science at the Smith School of Enterprise and the Environment at Oxford University. He's the author of Making Sense of Chaos, A Better Economics for a Better World, that will be published by Allen Lane on April 25th. Welcome to the interview, Dr. Farmer.
Thank you.
I'm fascinated by this because so many of my acquaintances within the energy space speak very highly of your work. And they often talk about the importance of integrating systems thinking into policy making. And I asked for an interview because a particularly someone I respect quite a bit suggested that I do so. And I come at this as someone who understands the energy, but not necessarily energy systems thinking. And so I suspect that many of my readers and listeners are the same. So I'm wondering if we can start with some general discussion of complexity, theory, systems thinking, and then more for, you know, segue into a discussion of how that might apply to the global energy system and the energy transition, if that works for you.
Sure, that sounds fine. So complex systems is about, a complex system science is about understanding what we call emergent phenomena. So an emergent phenomenon is one that happens when the building blocks generate behavior that's qualitatively different from themselves. So easy example, a neuron, it's a complicated cell, but no one would ever argue a neuron was conscious. Yet you hook 80 billion of them together in the right way and you get this conversation we're having. So you have an emergent phenomenon that just looks qualitatively different from what's underneath it. Lots of other examples, ant colonies, and even simpler examples, sometimes the weather can be an emergent phenomenon, because how do you get hurricanes and droughts and all the things you get from a situation where you have a very steady changing of the forces acting on the Earth, causing consequences that seem hard to infer from what you put in? So the key issue is that because it is a system, and because the components of a system can interact with each other to create, in non-trivial ways, to create rich phenomena, you really have to understand the system properties of these kind of things to get at the basis of what's going on. And the economy is, of course, is a very great example of a complex system.
In your work, you've done some very interesting things, like I was reading on some of your background, systems, we'll call them, in order to predict the stock market or to pick stocks, that sort of thing. Is that a practical application of the general principle?
Well, I have to say it was more just, I did, maybe just to clarify your remark, I was involved in starting one of the early quant trading firms that actually operated out of Santa Fe, New Mexico. And we did beat the market quite substantially and consistently. We did view it as a system, but a lot of it was about pattern recognition. To us, we didn't know much about stocks and what makes them go up and down. They were just data streams. And we spotted things in those data streams that were out of the ordinary in such a way that when we saw one set of indicators line up, we knew something else was about to follow. We just thought of some clever ways to search through the data to find those kind of events.
That sounds like the kind of big data analytics, number crunching that we're seeing more and more in industry.
Predictive
analytics, that sort of thing.
We were one of the early examples of big data and using serious computer power to milk knowledge out of big data.
So you were talking about well, I guess what I would call an anomalies that emerge out of these complex systems. And what role would human innovation play in a, you know, in complexity theory and in systems?
Well, human innovation is certainly one of the things that we're very interested in, understanding how it comes about, understanding its characteristics, and something I've been involved in quite a lot is trying to understand technological progress. You might think, oh, innovation, we can't predict it. But actually, in some cases, we can't predict what the innovations will be, but we can predict how fast things will progress. Moore's law being the great example. You know, in 1965, Gordon Moore said, I observe that the density of electronics components on integrated circuits is doubling every 18 months. I expect that'll keep happening. Well, he later adjusted to be every 2 years rather than every 18 months. But since he made that adjustment, his prediction has been remarkably accurate. And since he made the prediction, computers are a billion times more powerful than they were then. So he predicted it a long way out and through an enormous amount of change. Now, we used to think that that was just something very special. But what we see now from collecting a lot of data is that there are many technologies that improve, not all of them. In fact, most don't improve enough to be even easily measurable, but many of them do. Other examples relevant to your space besides transistors are solar photovoltaic, wind, lithium ion batteries, and hydrogen electrolyzers. So those are all examples of technologies that improve. In contrast, the price of oil now is roughly the same as it was a century ago. The price of coal is about the same as it was a century ago. The cost of making a solar module is 1/10,000th what it was when they were first used commercially in the Vanguard satellite in 1958.
I want to ask you about a corollary theory, which is Wright's law, because you conjoin them in your work in some way. And I have some interviews that I've done with a fellow who's in the solar industry that I'll get into in a moment. But if you could tell us how Wright's law fits into this.
So Wright's law is a precursor of Moore's law. It was postulated in 1936 by Theodore Wright, who was in the aviation business. He actually went on to run aviation manufacturer for the United States in World War II. And he noted that the cost of an airplane, of producing an airplane, dropped by 20% every time the cumulative production of that airplane from a specific factory doubled. And so it was originally a very narrow thing about airplanes and about specific factories. We've now seen that it applies to many other technologies, not just airplanes. And it also applies broadly globally. So every time we double the production of solar photovoltaic cells, the cost drops by about 20%, much like it did for airplanes, actually maybe even a little more. Can't remember the exact number, maybe more like 25. And now you might think, oh, that's completely different than Moore's law. And it looks that way at first, but if the production is increasing exponentially in time, then you get the same behavior from Wright's law as from Moore's law. Now, there's still conceptual, and by the way, we've tested that, and in many circumstances, it's hard to say which one works better. Wright's law works at least as well as Moore's law for predicting computer production, or predicting computer costs, excuse me, predicting computer costs. Now, but Wright's law is different because production is something we can control. Governments can have incentives to boost it and so forth. And it can be difficult to say which way the causation goes because Is production going up because costs are going down, or are costs going down because production's going up? We did a study on that of World War II, where we kind of knew the causality, and we showed that it is at least 50% of the drops in costs are caused by increases in production.
There is a fellow that I've interviewed a couple times. His name is Mike Andrade. He's based in Toronto, and he's the CEO of Morgan Solar. And he's been in this industry for about 30 years. And he's a very smart guy. And he has conjoined Wright's Law with Moore's Law in many of the same ways that you have. And he says, based on my experience in the electronics manufacturing industry, he said, the way he thinks about it is one is like the numerator and one is the denominator. And Wright's Law will explain the drop in costs, and Moore's Law will explain the continual rise in efficiencies. And he says the reason why this energy transition is different is that now energy for the first time is a technology that's produced in a factory. And so it will obey the laws that govern electronics manufacturing. Like when I was a young fellow in high school, in grade eight, I think it was, I had to buy a calculator. It was like $80 or $100. It was this enormous sum at the time. And now the marginal cost of making a calculator is zero because it comes on my phone. Just, it's a simple app, and it's far more. And it's that kind of drive to the marginal cost of zero, he says, that will govern energy technologies like solar panels, like wind turbines, like batteries, and so on. And that is a inherently more efficient and better than a commodity-driven energy system like fossil fuels. I just was curious about what you think about that.
Well, I agree with him that it's a very different situation because the technologies I mentioned, including solar photovoltaic, which is the most striking example, are manufactured goods that have dropped in cost fairly consistently. There's some wiggles in the curves, but I think energy is going to get cheaper than it's ever been as a result, and substantially cheaper. Now, efficiency is not as clear because efficiency, you know, pushes up against limits. Efficiency is not playing a big role in the drop in cost for solar energy that we've had. We may find other processes that are more efficient. So I don't think it's as clear how it's going to play out there. I think things will get more efficient over time, but unlike cost, which can just go down and down, it can't go below zero, but it can still drop exponentially. And it's not as clear to me what efficiency is going to do.
Yeah, I think he would point to things like battery energy density, for instance. It's going up about an average of 7% a year, and it looks like we're headed to some step changes, maybe with solid state batteries in a few years, those sorts
totally
of things.
Totally agree with that.
Yeah. Totally and I think, and he would also think, I think, point to his field, which is solar, where they're talking about integrating perovskites with polysilicon to increase efficiencies from, you know, 22 to maybe 30-35%. And we just, that our ability to innovate seems to keep pushing those limits all the time, even if they're not quite as neat and tidy so that they could be described as a law.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with all of that. And, you know, in batteries, I agree with him. We may see a real breakthrough because, I mean, if you look at capacitors, which are, in a sense, a very simple solid state energy storage device, the cost and performance have been dropping at like 30% per year for a long time. So if we can get on that curve, we'll really see things take off.
There's a lot of attention being paid to China these days. And I have to say that in the past year, China has come on my radar. And I've spent a lot of time looking at the IEA data about China's investment in clean energy technologies and how that came about. And it seems to me that the Chinese have figured out long before the Europeans and the North Americans that the fundamental difference between energy as a technology and energy as a commodity. And that, and they seem to have been able to scale. They seem to have been able to increase efficiencies. And now they dominate all of these supply chains and products that we know so well. And what are the limits to that? You know, if you're looking at China, can they're at 6 cents, or sorry, 11 cents a watt for solar panels now. Can they go to 1 or 2 cents? What, how high can their efficiencies go? Where are the limits to this, do you think?
I don't think there are known limits. You know, many people have postulated something called floor costs. There's just some limit below which you can't go. And in one of our papers, we document the floor costs that were postulated by integrated assessment models, which try and study the transition of the integrated of the energy system. And we show all the postulated floor costs as lines. And then we show how the price of solar modules has just punched through them again and again and again. And I've looked at a lot of data on plots of technology costs through time. There's really no evidence for floor costs. And now bear in mind that Wright's law does mean a sort of asymptotic slowing down on the rate of improvement, or to put it differently, to keep at the same rate of improvement, you have the production has to increase exponentially. But as soon as the production isn't increasing exponentially, then that means every time you want the cost to drop by another, whatever the increment is, 20%, then you need to double the cumulative production. So double the production, you know, produce as much as you produced up until that point in time to get that next 20%. So it means it gets harder and harder to drive the cost down. That doesn't mean it hits a floor that you can't go underneath.
Yeah, the example often used is solar, and it's taken us 20 years to get to where we are now. In the next 3 years, apparently we're supposed to double that again, so we'll see some a fairly major cost reduction. Then only 18 months to double it again, but it would seem that at some point there is a limit to the growth. You know, yeah. when solar and wind and whatever other hydro and nuclear, when we've squeezed fossil fuels out of the system, when we no longer have to grow power grids, we're basically electrified, then the rate of growth, it would seem, would drop. And I guess the only question is then is when? Is that 10 years, 20 years, 50 years from now?
Yeah, I agree. Though it's not clear, because let me back up and say a little bit about Moore's law versus Wright's law and maybe a different way to think about it. There's a certain component of technological progress that happens from the economy as a whole. So the example I like to imagine is, suppose all the automobile designers in the world, like Rip Van Winkle, they suddenly fell asleep. The rest of the economy went on. Cars just went as they were for 20 years. Now, those designers wake up. Imagine they fell asleep in 1970 and they woke up in 1990. What would they say? They'd look around, they go, oh my God, there are these new things called microprocessors. We could put these in cars and do all kinds of things that we're doing with primitive mechanical computers much better. And suddenly, boom, cars would get better. So the point is, progress just chunks away, and oftentimes we're drawing on elements from other parts of the technosphere to improve a specific part of the technosphere. And so that's the inexorable part. But specifically for solar cells, something's going to slow down when we reach the point where we've saturated, because solar cells have been growing at the order of 25 or 30% per year for a long time now. The energy consumption's only growing at about 2% per year globally. So that's a much slower rate. Now, even if, because energy gets cheaper, it starts to go faster, we're still talking 3% or maybe 4%, but not 20 or 30%. So yes, insofar as Wright's law is the right description, we expect that will slow down.
Now,
I just wanted to give you all the caveats because, you know, there's a lot of devils in the details of these things.
Fair enough. I want to ask a question about systems and enabling technologies, and I'll tell a little story to illustrate my point. Last September, the World Petroleum Congress was held in Calgary, Alberta, and I went and reported on it for 3 days. And I was walking down the looking for people to interview, and I came across a technical section on materials, and there was a session going on, and the moderator was a fellow called Dr. Ibrahim Abba, who was the VP of technology at Saudi Aramco. And he said something I should have maybe known, but I didn't know. He said, yes, we're having an energy transition, but we're also having a materials transition. And I thought, he said, we're figuring out how to make materials out of hydrocarbons in ways we never did before. And this will probably be how oil and gas survives in some form or another in a low carbon world. And since then, I've thought, well, what other enabling technologies or what other sectors are being transformed? And we can think of artificial intelligence and supercomputers and on and on and on and on. And it seems like there has never been a time in history where there were so many advances going on in so many other sectors that all can come together to enable innovation in energy.
Yeah, I agree with him. You know, in a sense, technological progress boils down to energy, materials, and information. And we're making rapid progress on all of those fronts. So, and they're interacting, of course, because, you know, information, better AI, better computing allows us to design better materials, allows us to make progress on the energy front. So I completely agree with what you just said.
One of the reasons I asked to interview you is because a fellow that who reads your works, a big fan, but he lives in a rural Alberta community that has access to clean energy. They have a wind turbine farms nearby. And the question that occurred to me was, okay, we have these new systems emerging around energy, and to some extent, they'll be decentralized. What does this mean for smaller communities that aren't located in the metropolises? They're out in the hinterland. Can they plug into this new system and have development opportunities that maybe were not available to them 10 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago?
Well, I mean, on one hand, most metropolises have access to electricity, which is from a grid, and it costs a little more one place than the other. So we've already democratized energy in that regard. But it is true that anybody who wants it now can have energy independence by, you know, putting enough solar cells on their roof and buying enough batteries. And that applies at all scales. Now, it's true that residential solar is still substantially more expensive than commercial, and I think that dichotomy will continue, but it gives us a lot more choice. And I think it's important to realize with the renewable energy revolution, we're going to win not just by dealing with 75% of greenhouse gas emissions, but we're going to make energy cheaper than it's ever been. We're going to make it cleaner than it's ever been. We're going to make it more sustainable than it's ever been. We're going to reduce energy volatility because prices will be much steadier. So, of course, energy security. We all can get energy security if we want it. It may cost a little bit, but it's now available to just about anybody.
What about the opportunities that come with electricity being eventually the cost of it dropping to the point of the marginal cost is zero? And I think of Tony Seba. I've interviewed him a few times over the years, and this was one of his original ideas back in 2017, I think, when he first started talking about it. And his point was that once the cost of energy drops to that level, that systems will change in ways we could never imagine. Humans will take advantage of them and they'll do things with them that we maybe wouldn't never have thought of otherwise. What's your take on that?
Well, I think he has a good point. I mean, history just shows that energy powers everything. Without energy, civilization grinds to a halt. And, you know, it's only 4% of GDP, but every bit, if you look at the input table for any kind of business, everybody requires energy. So now, and if you have the energy, allows you to do things that, you know, to automate activities, to do many things. I think one of the biggest beneficiaries is going to be the global South, underdeveloped countries who, you know, I think there's a good chance they're going to be able to leapfrog by going directly to renewables and having a solid energy supply without ever having to really go the fossil fuel route. And particularly if it gets cheap and plentiful, they will really benefit from that.
That raises a very interesting question because, as you know, there are competing narratives for how fast the energy transition will go. I think the leader of the slow energy transition narrative is OPEC, and they released their world oil outlook 2045 last fall. And I read it, and it's loaded with assumptions about what will happen in the non-OECD world is how they think about it. And they argue that the electric technologies are still too expensive. Governments are tired. They either haven't got the money or taxpayers are tired of subsidizing them. And so the non-OECD world will stick with oil and gas for decades to come. And that's the basis for their increasing demand forecasts out to 2045. But that doesn't, it's counterintuitive, I think, because I'm with you. I would think, you know, if I'm Africa and I have this incredible solar resource, why would I not go with the lowest cost form of energy? And not only is it low cost, but it's flexible. I can do a microgrid. I can put it on my house and be my own microgrid. I can do virtual power plants. There's so much more as an emerging economy that I can do with this technology at lower cost than I can do with the old hydrocarbons. What would be your take on, you know, that debate?
I totally agree with you. I mean, we, of course, need to get better and cheaper energy storage solutions for pure renewable energy systems. But I think the factors you just said are just going to get stronger and stronger through time. It's hard for me to imagine that in 20 years, those countries aren't going to be exclusively buying renewables because they'll be a factor of 5 or 10 cheaper. Now, that said, I think the Saudis will be able to hang on for a while. Why? Because as they get squeezed, as the oil market gets squeezed, the demand will go down, but the supply will be the same. So prices will go down. And so we'll see all the expensive providers pushed out of business, but the really cheap providers like the Saudis will be able to go on for a while. But their markets are going to be dropping through time faster than they realize. I think maybe if I could just add something else on that, you know, we are looking at the data on technology deployment. Technologies follow something that's called an S-curve, where starts out slow and then it accelerates and then it flattens out again. And hence S, because it looks a little bit like an S. And so we've collected data on many different technologies that have gone through their S curves, from canals to mobile phones. And what we see is they're remarkably universal. They explain more about what happens than the specific factors that make each technology different. And if you apply that, we've developed a method for making probabilistic forecasts for things like solar and wind. And when we apply that, it looks like the transition is going to happen pretty fast. So in other words, because the change is exponential looks small, it looks small, and then it suddenly appears on stage and gets big. And we're going to see that happening.
Yeah, the old saying, slow, 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 really, really fast. Yeah. I think applies here. We're big fans of the S curve here, as well as the bell curve to explain consumer adoption of technologies. And one of the, when I give presentations, as I often do on the energy transition, I make the point that this transition has a very long tail on that S. If you go back, solar panels first appeared in the 70s, and then wind turbines in the 80s, and lithium ion batteries in 91, and EV prototypes in the late 1990s, on and on. We've really been at this energy transition for 30 to 50 years already, which is why those technologies come to the inflection point when the round part of the bottom of the S curve, and suddenly they grab our attention and we think, oh my God, the energy transition started yesterday. No, yep. It started many decades ago, which is why we're now in the fast part of it. We're up on the hockey stick part of the curve. Is that what your probabilistic analysis?
That's exactly what we think. We think we're not at the peak yet. The peak's still several years out. Quite a few years out, yeah. And when we get at the peak growth rate, we're only 50% done. So, but once as we get into that zone, growth rate gets faster every year. The absolute growth rate of how many, you know, watts get deployed, it increases exponentially. So, and I think we've been on the transition even longer than you said. I mean, goes back to 1958 in the Vanguard satellite. Electric cars, you know, there were precursor electric cars a long time ago. And back to your other point, electric cars are intrinsically cheaper to manufacture than internal combustion engines. They're much simpler devices. And so I think that's going to start to kick in as they become more and more routine and as batteries keep dropping, because right now the batteries are the limiting factor in the cost.
Well, we'll debate 1958 versus the 1970s over a beer in New Mexico sometime.
Sounds good.
But this is poignant for me because I'm involved in the debate within Alberta about how fast the energy transition is going. And Alberta flies under the radar for many people on oil and gas, but Canada is the fourth largest oil producer in the world and the fifth largest gas producer. And all of that is centered in Alberta. Even if it gets done in another province, the companies that do it are headquartered in Calgary. And so this is enormously important to both the energy transition and climate policy and the future of Alberta. I mean, it is in some ways, it could be argued, the engine of the Canadian economy. And if it craters, it's hugely important for workers and governments that rely on tax revenues. And we've been arguing this point that Dr. Abba made, which is that it needs to begin pivoting towards materials. You know, get away from providing feedstock for fuels and get into feedstock for materials and build the materials manufacturing. That's a hard sell. And a lot of it has to do with the power of incumbents to impede growth. And this is where I'm going to get back to your systems. It's about information. The information that we're talking about here never seems to penetrate the big shield that the incumbents have erected around Alberta. Not the media, not the government, not the political class. It's just a big group think that this kind of information never get to hear it, or they just ignore it. They explain it away. The role of information in systems change. Your thoughts?
Well, it's very important, and not just information, understanding and prediction. You know, Moore's Law was important because it allowed organizations to predict what they would be able to do when and plan their whole research efforts around it. You know, a remarkable story, you know, the technology to do Pixar computer animation was basically ready 5 years before they did it. They got it ready and they said, well, we just have to wait for Moore's Law to catch up and then we can do this. And meanwhile, they got everything all ready. So as soon as they were there, bam, we got Toy Story. And now, in this case, it's really important for the people in Calgary to realize that the money cows they have now is going to dry up. They're in the horse and buggy business. they better find another industry fast. And maybe materials is the right answer. Maybe something else is the answer. I think that requires some explanation, but they need to really be planning, because it's just not going to keep going. And CCS, carbon sequestration and storage, is not going to be the answer. It's too expensive. And the thing is, with renewable energy getting cheaper than fossil fuel energy, even without CCS, you can't then add CCS and expect it to stay competitive. It just makes it worse.
So, yeah, there's some modeling by the Canadian Energy Regulator that shows that if the oil sands companies in particular are required to pay the full cost of their climate compliance, because it's some of the dirtiest oil on the planet, that basically makes them uneconomic.
Yeah, and I would argue that even if they're not required to do that, they're going to become uneconomical, period. So I think it's one reason why I'm putting a lot of focus these days on predicting technological change, because that has such enormous ramifications for society in general. And we need to think ahead to, you know, make sure we're not stranding labor so we can have a just transition as well as a fast transition and an orderly transition, because disorder in the transition is not going to be good for anybody either.
Is that argument the basis for your book, The Making Sense of Chaos, A Better Economics for a Better World?
Well, that's part of it. My book is more generally about a different way of doing economics. Standard economic models are based on the idea that we're all selfish utility maximizers who figure out the perfect decisions to maximize our utility. And in contrast, we in complexity economics, you know, model the economy as a dynamical system where the agents make decisions using heuristics or, you know, simple logic, simple learning algorithms, which is more the way people really do things. And furthermore, it allows us to make feasible models where we can really put in all the structural detail that's so important for understanding the economy. So the book's about that more broadly, but this particular topic is an important subset of the book.
Given the importance of technology change to your systems thinking, I have an explanation, you know, when I'm talking to people about, okay, why do people adopt an EV or don't adopt an EV? And my point is that anybody looking at any technology basically does a calculation of four variables: what it costs you to buy it, what it costs you to operate it, how much risk is attached to it, and how much value, value that you can't measure economically, could be status, it could be some other thing that you value. And all of us make our individual calculations depending on our circumstances and our history and all of that. And is that the kind of decisions that are made in real life, decision-making process in real life, that your model is able to approximate?
Certainly that's an example of something we could throw in, and actually throw in a fifth thing, which is that people key off of their peers. They look at what their friends have. They say, hey, I like this car. It's cool. I'll buy one for myself. So I think that plays a very big role as well. And actually helps us explain why S-curves behave the way they do. We basically try and just understand how people do things, and we put it in the model. We try for what I call verisimilitude. You want your model to have the same logical processes in it that the real people and real systems have in them, rather than having to make as if arguments. Well, it doesn't work this way, but let's say it's as if it did.
I interview a number of classical economists, we'll call them, about the various aspects of energy, and I think some of their heads just exploded. How are your ideas being accepted within the, you know, general economics field?
They're seeping their way in. My book is significantly about trying to make that happen, trying to accelerate that process. I was very happy. I got a great commendation on my book from Larry Summers, who's a pretty mainstream economist. And so in my experience, some of the best economists are open to these ideas, but many aren't. It's not surprising. It's a fundamentally different way to do economics, requires a different skill set, different knowledge base. They have the incumbent advantage right now, don't want to lose the franchise. And
shades of Blockbuster.
Yeah. So it's not going to change easily, but I think change is beginning to happen.
Is when you say change is beginning to happen, are you referring primarily to North America, or is it the case that outside of North America, the economics profession is more willing to entertain new ideas like yours?
Outside, definitely. Europe and Asia are much more open to different ways of doing economics. Economics is a field that's completely dominated now by America. All the top journals are here, all the top schools. But this is going to challenge that, because the Skunk Works project that we have been is now growing to maturity. And it takes a model to beat a model. Our models are starting to beat their models. And so I think we're going to see a lot of change. And it may change the American dominance of the economics profession.
Where on the S-curve would you put your innovation?
I would say we're about a decade ahead of maximum adoption. But there are significant uncertainties in that. I think it's going to happen. The question is when, not if. And I've started a company, and one of my main motivations for that company is to bring things up to scale and reduce them to practice, so that we really have practical solutions for the kind of questions that we've been discussing on your program today. And I think we're getting close to providing those. Actually, in some cases, we already are providing those. And I think that there's a huge hunger for that kind of ability and capacity.
I'd like to draw our conversation to a close, Dr. Farmer. Well, just give you the opportunity. If there was an idea or two that you would like to leave with my audience, what would they be?
Well, good question. You've done a great job of bringing out, I think, all the main points. I think we live in interesting times. I think the energy transition is going to be a very interesting turning point in human history, like the Industrial Revolution was. And I think because it will mean we have cheap, clean, convenient energy, tiny little batteries that can hold a ton of energy, we're going to have some really sweet technologies, but it will influence the whole progress of civilization on a lot of different fronts, make all of our lives better. It's one of many significant changes we're going through right now, as we with artificial intelligence and trying to sort of get control over the planet, so that we can, it's like our garden, we need to tend it properly.
If I remember correctly, it was Tony Seba that made this argument, but forgive me if it wasn't. But I believe he made the point that while the technology has the great potential to make all of our lives better and to herald us into another epoch of human civilization, we still have to make the right decisions. And if we Yep. make the wrong decisions, we can go the other direction, I guess. What do you think of that?
No, he's right. Technology's powerful but dangerous thing, and technologies almost always have negative side effects. Automobiles are great, but look at what they did to cities. Anybody who lives under a freeway has good right to complain about. And anybody who's been run over by a car knows that there are negative side effects. though we did get rid of horse shit. So each technology is replacing the negative effects of the one before it. There are some negative side effects of renewables too, but I think they're much smaller. We do need to make the right choices. And I think what I'm hoping is that having better economic models will help us make those right choices, help us make them earlier and more clearly so that we can make the transition faster and stop emitting greenhouse gases earlier.
Well, on that note, that's a great note to end our conversations. Dr. Farmer, thank you very much for this.
You're welcome. Thank you.